Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm, with a live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this weekend edition, another terror attack in Europe, details about that. Also, the U.S. strikes Syria. No doubt you've been watching the news coverage. Historically, how successful have U.S. airstrikes been? We'll take a look at some of that. And also, a list for you of the most and least stressful states in the United States. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. And we have an online site as well, kpcg.fm. And at thetrumpet.com, you can listen to the link there. Lots of great places to listen to the content here from KPCG, the TuneIn app, other places, iTunes, all sorts of places you can go. I'm Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo here today as well. Lots happening. Things happen quick these days.
Yeah.
And so we've got quite a few stories to get to. First one here is a terror attack in Sweden. This is from Fox News. A truck is driven into a crowd at a shopping center in central Stockholm, killing it. Well, they don't. The numbers vary, so I guess we'll just wait and see. Several, at least. The numbers are kind of jumping around. Happened on Friday. At least one person has been arrested so far, according to the Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven. Sweden has been attacked, he said. This indicates that this indicates that it is an act of terror. Police say a lorry, or a big vehicle, I guess, ran over a crowd at Ahlins department store. Broadcaster SVT says at least five people have been killed. Other reports say less. I'm sure that number will jump around. Photos from the scene showed a beer truck sticking out of the department store. And they reported that the Swedish beer maker Spendrup said one of its trucks had been carjacked earlier Friday. So it's terrorism just keeps kind of morphing. And here what they're doing is hijacking delivery trucks that, you know, you would expect to see come to these areas. They're delivering products, except they're hijacked and now they're going to run people over. So terror has a way of surprising people.
Yeah, terrorism doesn't have to be sophisticated. In fact, I think on the whole, most terrorist attacks involve knives or vehicles. They're not explosives or maybe other things we think of, or they're not as complex as something we saw on September 11th, nothing like that. And so with these very simple type attacks, they're hard to stop because unless you have tabs on the individual who is going to commit it, you don't really know what they're going to do because they're just using everyday vehicles or items to commit the attacks. So it puts democracies who welcome in immigrants from places or just open societies where we don't have police on every street corner. It just makes things difficult to live and how to cope with those kinds of attacks.
Yeah, I think it would put some real fear in the minds of the drivers of these vehicles, as well as just people in general. I mean, you see, if you're in a crowded shopping area and you see delivery trucks or semis, it put it in your mind, well, I don't know, you know, this could be one of those situations. Over here in the U.S., they have the Brinks truck drivers. They take the money from different places to other places.
Yeah.
And they have to carry guns and they have to really keep their eye out because they'd be a target for just people stealing. And so now what do? Do you take all the just average drivers of delivery vehicles and arm them and say, you've got to watch out? You know, I thought about how we had to change the way we fly after 9/11, and it's caused just delays and headaches and all sorts of things. And now terrorism morphs in Europe anyway to these types of attacks where they hijack vehicles. And how does that change that system? It's causing a lot of problems that cost a lot, that delay things. Because of terrorism.
Yeah, well, if you look at, this is a more extreme example, but I think the relevance will become clear. In Iraq, when American troops there, the first thing that they did was they, in Baghdad, they had to create a secure Baghdad for the government, and then they moved out to different parts of the country. The only way they could stop terrorist attacks like this, where you had suicide bombers in cars, or just cars running into U.S. soldiers, they pretty much built a fortress out of Baghdad with huge concrete barriers. And they closed certain roads to only military traffic and that sort of thing. So there weren't no attacks. The attacks stopped, and Zarqawi and others, Al-Qaeda, moved on to different cities eventually. But they had to make that city into a fortress to stop that kind of attack. Now, that's in an all-out war zone, so it's slightly different. But what's the options for Western democracies? Do we create car barriers at every single public place? Do we create barriers along the roads? Do we put armed troops there? It's just a really difficult situation, because the only examples we have of fixing this is to go to an extreme where you create physical barriers to stop things like this. So it's just the only other option are ones that have been talked about and are very unattractive, like stopping immigration. In Belgium and France, having a police state where the police have powers to search and to do all these things they don't normally have. So it's a tough choice.
It also reminds me of something that came up in the news a few months ago. February, I guess. If you look back, February 20th, this is a write-up from CNN. Trump's Sweden comment raises questions. He was at a rally, and he said, what happened last night in Sweden? And nothing apparently had happened that exact night. He said he was referencing the fact that there's, I forget exactly, more immigrants or something was happening there. And people kind of laughed at that and mocked him quite a bit. Well, here we are, a terror attack in Sweden. It's just interesting how he may have been off on what he said. I don't remember all the details, but people were so quick to kind of mock the idea that there would be problems in these different areas. And now there are. So I'm not really saying anything about that other than it's just interesting how he's been right on a few things. Maybe he didn't have the timing right on that, but he was warning about some of those things, and people kind of laughed at it, and then here we sit with an actual attack.
Yeah, that's one of the first things I thought of when I saw that, is that I think he was he didn't precisely word his phrase like maybe he should have when he said it, but he was referring to an actual news report. He just maybe should have worded it better. But still, after that, there was a string of reports coming out how Sweden is the most stable place in Europe, how they've welcomed the most immigrants, but there's like less than 1% crime in immigrants, and how it's a good template for the rest of Europe to how to take in immigrants and from these Middle Eastern countries and that sort of thing. But lo and behold, like you said, here's evidence that it's not working, and that perhaps what the president was fearful of is we're seeing the fruits of that.
And, of course, the debate now is always, well, how extreme do you get in your vetting process? Or do you limit who can travel in and out of your nations, whether it's here in the U.S. or in Europe? And so it's something that keeps coming up in conversation because of things like this. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of it going forward. Another attack there again that was in Sweden. And, of course, they'll have more details about that as it develops. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, today. Also, check out thetrumpet.com. They have a lot about Syria and what happened there just the last few days here. The top story at thetrumpet.com, the U.S. airstrike on Syria and the Psalm 83 Alliance. After the dust settles, watch for the prophesied break between Syria and Iran. That's by Richard Palmer. Related to that, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, America's abject failure in Syria, and AP Syrian gas attack is enormous political gamble. So quite a bit about Syria there on thetrumpet.com. Fox News, this is their write-up today. Syria strikes. International community reacts to U.S. bombing of airfield. Some negative, but mostly positive responses to what President Trump did.
Yeah, it's, from what I understand, about between 50 and 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles were used. And I think most of the countries you expect to support the U.S. did. All the former British English-speaking nations, Japan, all the big allies, Israel. And then on the opposite coin, those who Russia has already come out and vehemently said it's an act of aggression against a sovereign state, which is ridiculous because Syria's not really a sovereign state anymore. It's barely a nation. And then you had China and Iran also oppose it. So you can see the sharp divide in the world and who's supporting who.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it broke down, according to what Fox said. And so there's different opinions there. I think most nations are glad to see some action happen there because it's a disaster, serious. I mean, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but there have been so many killed there over the last how many ever years it's been. It's just an ongoing war. And, you know, you see some of the footage from inside of there, and it is it's just unbelievable. I mean, the cities are reduced to rubble. I saw some video a couple weeks ago of shot from the street of when something went off. I don't know what kind of a explosion it was, but some kind, and just shook the whole place, and the children are screaming and running. Really put you at an eye level as to what was happening there, and the horror and the terror that people feel. It's like a bad dream, but you can't wake up from it. And we're just not aware in the West about what that really is like, unless, say, somebody had been over there for the military or something. I mean, we just don't live that type of life here. But it's not a TV show. You know, this is these people's lives, and just keeps going and going.
Yeah, I think the latest numbers are about 500,000 dead, 2 million displaced. So just massive numbers. It's probably the worst disaster of the 21st century so far in terms of in terms of numbers. But yeah, I was watching a movie last night with some kids and my wife, and I just looked on Twitter and I saw all the news stories about the cruise missile launches, and in a series of just a couple hours, a few hours, 60 huge warheads struck at that airfield, and then I think it cost about $84 million to launch those missiles. So a lot of money, but when you consider what Assad has been responsible for, dropping bombs full, like barrels full of explosives on his own people. He's not just attacking military targets. He's just killing people indiscriminately. Then you also have, like you said, even if the war stopped today, it would probably take over 10 years just to rebuild everything. It looks like Haiti, when that big earthquake came and basically leveled the whole country. That's what basically Syria looks like. It's just been from war instead of a natural disaster. And it's just eventually someone's going to have to intervene with greater force, or there's really not going to be anything left to fight for there.
Yeah, you know, for Assad, it's, you know, what is he the ruler of? Ruins?
Yeah.
Ruins and death. There's really nothing there. And, it's terrible footage. I mean, from the last attack that was the big one and now this most recent one. Yeah, it's horrible to look at. The children dying, and it's not a pleasant situation. So anyway, there's a lot more about that at thetrumpet.com today. This one's kind of interesting, too, just from the standpoint that media outlets are starting to talk about war a little bit more. This is from The Sun. Could World War III really happen? How chemical warfare and nuclear weapons could lead to the apocalypse? That's one of their headlines today. So I think they've got their ideas and their thoughts on it, but it should make the listeners want to go check out thetrumpet.com. A little better information there. But just the fact that other people are reporting on it, it's on people's minds because it's happening. Chemical attacks are happening in Syria on a small scale, but there's plenty of terrorists out there that would love to do it on a large scale.
Yeah, well, I saw one story where one person pointed out, like we talked about yesterday, on the 100th anniversary of the First World War, we have the airstrikes from the U.S. And then at the same time on Twitter, apparently World War III was trending with the hashtag. So people are, I think, thinking about it, and they're realizing that the scale of warfare and the weapons that are starting to be unleashed on more and more often is pretty terrifying because they're in the hands of people you can't trust or you can't really rationalize what they're going to do next. And so it's good people are aware of it, but the problem is only one place can accurately tell you what's going to happen.
Yeah. So check out thetrumpet.com. I'm sure there'll be more about all of these topics on the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program this weekend. So make sure you listen for that as well. And we're going to talk later in the program about some of the history of U.S. airstrikes, how effective they've been. So we'll talk about that coming up in a bit. Speaking of warfare, this is this could be a potentially interesting documentary that's come out. I haven't seen it yet, so you know, I take that for what it's worth. But it seems like it would be interesting. When the film greats went to war. They say when the great classic Hollywood filmmaker George Stevens put his career on hold to enter the service in 1943, he left behind a treasure box of entertainments like the luminous Astaire Rogers musical Swing Time and Woman of the Year, the comedy that united Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, some famous Hollywood personalities. Upon his return, Stevens made some of the finest films of his career, A Place in the Sun and Giant among them. But for very specific reasons, he no longer had the heart to make the light comedies he'd become known for. So this documentary looks at five different filmmakers from that time period who went to war and came back, and then they started making war films. And the title of the documentary is Five Came Back, and it's on Netflix. I think it'd be pretty interesting to check out.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, especially... we've been talking a lot about how movies get it wrong when it comes to recounting history, but it's good to look at the flip side and how history shapes filmmakers, how when they're a part of something like World War or different experiences like that, how they start making different movies because they've been moved by what they've seen and they want to either recount the true event or through some kind of story, convey to the audience what they felt and what they experienced on the battlefield. So that would be really interesting because probably movie makers have a huge influence on people's minds more so than ever. So it's good to look back and see how that whole process works.
Yeah, we've been talking and writing about that Churchill documentary. Not documentary, movie. Nothing. It's nothing like a documentary. Movie where they really kind of paint him in a bad light and it's just inaccurate. But this one looks like it would be a little better. Five Came Back. It's Laurent Bozerow's superb documentary adapted by Mark Harris from his 2014 book. And it's now on Netflix. The picture focuses on five directors, Frank Capra, William Wyler, John Ford, John Huston, and Stevens, who left thriving careers to join the war effort, using their skills to make propaganda films for the U.S. government. Narrated by Meryl Streep and featuring commentary from Steven Spielberg and Francis Ford Coppola, among others, Five Came Back brings the wartime work of these filmmakers into sharp focus. For example, clips from William Wyler's extraordinary 1944 documentary, The Memphis Belle, a story of a flying fortress which recorded the 25th and final bombing mission of a group of young B-17 pilots, drives home just how entwined these directors became with real-life subjects. As for Stevens, he headed a U.S. Army Signal Corps film unit that recorded the Normandy invasion. So some of that footage we see, these guys shot it.
Yeah, that's... although I think there's always criticism for the media going to war, especially when they maybe report it inaccurately. But if it wasn't for some media people putting their lives on the line, we wouldn't have any images on which to remember those great events like Normandy.
Yeah, and also Stevens here, the filmmaker George Stevens, not only was he there for Normandy invasion, he was one of the first on the scene at Dachau. And he filmed that.
Yeah, actually, I just watched this a couple years ago. The British government finally released a Holocaust documentary made by Alfred Hitchcock. And they banned it for 70 years because they thought it was too graphic. That was acted right after World War II, and they finally lifted the ban just recently. But yeah, he was a British filmmaker, and when he got the footage and saw everything, he put together a documentary using a lot of footage the public has never seen before, but was deemed too graphic, and it was put on the back burner. So now it's on YouTube. I think you can watch it, and it's the world debut. But yeah, a lot of those filmmakers in Media Man saw some things they probably wish they couldn't see. But it's good that they recorded it for history.
Yeah. The stuff that he shot at Dachau, that George Stevens shot, was used at the Nuremberg trials as evidence. But as this documentary, Five Came Back, shows, he locked it away in a warehouse and didn't retrieve it until 1959, the footage of Dachau. As he prepared to adapt the Diary of Anne Frank, Five Came Back tells us that he went alone to a screening room to watch the footage that he shot of Dachau, but he could only get through about a minute, and then he drove it back to the warehouse and he locked it up and never looked at it again. That shows you what impact it had on him.
Yeah, I mean, because I think we've all seen Holocaust pictures and videos and all that stuff, but for him, much like other men who were in a similar place, when you smell the concentration camps, when you you can see the people's eyes, in their eyes, and you see all those things and the sounds and the sights, all that comes rushing back to you when you see those images. For us, we're more detached from it. But for them, when you're actually there, it haunts you.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, you know, going in and then seeing that, being overwhelmed by it, but then having to do your job, which is to really capture the images that you want to look away from. But you got to record them and make sure you're focused and make sure, you know, your camera's working correctly. So
yeah,
this would be a really interesting documentary. Potentially have not seen it yet, but it looks like it could be good. Five Came Back, and it tells the story of five Hollywood filmmakers that went to World War II and what they did there as far as capturing some of that. And, of course, it's hard to come back and make comedies after you've lived life's great drama.
Well, I know John Ford, because he teamed up with John Wayne and made a lot of famous Westerns. And if you watch his Westerns, the ones after World War II, they're not as happy. The guy doesn't get the girl. They're not about those types of stories. They're about people losing loved ones, men living a hard life and dying lonely. It's about those themes. They're not about happy ending. So perhaps that's part of it as well.
Yeah. So could be pretty interesting. Might be worth seeing. Every once in a while, some documentaries come out that are worth seeing. Here's a business note. Sometimes you go into a restaurant and you may think to yourself, I wonder who owns this restaurant. In a lot of cases, it's a big chain, and they're being gobbled up, no pun intended, by some of these bigger corporations. Now, this one, Krispy Kreme owner buys Panera for $7.5 billion. So if you've ever been to Panera restaurant, I've been there. I like it. Krispy Kreme owns them. So I don't know if they're going to have more donuts or what. Sandwich chain Panera has agreed to sell itself to JAB. It's a German conglomerate that owns Krispy Kreme and the Einstein and Noah bagel chains. So those are all owned by the same company now.
Oh, that's interesting. I know during last year I was at a busy time for work, and so my wife and I, we discovered that at Panera you can order online. Mm-hmm. And then drive there and just pick it up. It has your name on it. You just pick it up and walk out, which makes me scared that someone could just walk in and pick up anything that's there and walk out, because they don't even check it. But hopefully no one ever does that. But anyway, it was so convenient, because by the time you drive from your computer to there, it's ready for you to pick up. It's just I think a lot of restaurants do that, but I was just pretty impressed by it.
Yeah, there's been quite a few restaurant mergers lately. Burger King and Tim Hortons owner, Restaurant Brands QSR, which is backed by Warren Buffett, they bought Popeye's Louisiana Chicken earlier this year. Burger King, Tim Hortons, and Popeye's all owned by the same guy. It's kind of funny, because you kind of look at them like they're competing restaurants, and in a way they are, but they're all owned by the same company,
yeah.
So they're making your money one way or the other. They're hoping you go to Burger King for lunch, Tim Hortons for coffee, and then Popeye's for dinner, and then they'd be happy. Bob Evans Farms sold its restaurant business to private equity firm Golden Gate Capital for $565 million in January. Golden Gate acquired Red Lobster from Olive Garden owner Darden Restaurants in 2014. So those are shifting around as well. And Darden just announced last week it was buying casual dining chain Cheddar Scratch Kitchen. You ever heard of that?
No, I don't think I've even seen one before.
I've never heard of it either, but it must be popular in some places. $780 million for that one. And then finally, popular sandwich chain Jimmy John's sold the majority stake last September to investment company Rourke Capital. So they're all owned by some of the, I guess, a few companies. that might be good, might be bad. I don't know what it'll be, but it's. I remember when I realized that multiple things were owned by the same person. It's actually when I first started in radio, and I always thought certain radio stations were kind of competing, and in a way they were, but then I realized they were all owned by the same guy or a few people. And sometimes we're in the same building, and you'd see the people. And, you know, if you just listen to a few stations, you kind of think, oh, they're rivals. They work in the same building sometimes. So it was an eye-opener for me when I was a young man.
Yeah, actually, on my honeymoon, my wife and I went to a resort that's owned by Bass Pro. And we had to sit through their pitch about something because we got a deal on our hotel. And it was really interesting. But at that meeting, the lady presenter, she announced that Bass Pro just bought Cabela's, which is the main rival to Bass Pro in like fishing and hunting and stuff. So basically Bass Pro owns everything. So if you want to go, some people like Cabela's more than Bass Pro and vice versa. Well, it's all owned by the same company now. Mm-hmm. So they have a monopoly on that market. Besides, I guess, what you can buy at Walmart.
Right.
But it's just...
And Walmart probably owns everybody. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works with all the different companies. Here's an interesting list. I don't know if you'll like this one, Abraham. Which countries have the most crybabies? When they're talking about literal babies that cry a lot.
Okay.
I
can tolerate that.
Babies with colic. They say the rules of three is what they're looking at. Refers to a baby who cries for more than 3 hours a day on at least 3 days in any 1 week. That's a lot of crying.
Yeah. So that's 21 hours of crying at least.
Too much.
Yeah.
Too much crying. Here we go. The study found that babies in Canada, Italy, and the United Kingdom cry the most in the world.
Huh. It's full for Canada. It's probably because it's cold and they're... they probably have a learning how to eat the harsh Canadian diet up there.
Canadian babies, they say, lead the way with 34% of four-week-olds crying inconsolably, followed by two-week-olds in the UK at 28% and Italian nine-week-olds at 20%. So that's that can wear you down over time if you're a parent. Meanwhile, babies in Denmark, Germany, and Japan cry the least. Only 5.5% of Danish babies are colicky, followed by German babies at 6.7% and Japanese babies at 2%. American babies, as far as crying goes, are solidly average. So, but they say in Denmark, the most parents hold the babies more. And they think that maybe that has something to do with it. They're not sure.
Huh. Yeah, it is interesting. It'd be good to look into more deeply, see maybe how many babies are in, have nurses or nannies, I guess what I meant, and are in daycare, mm-hmm. that type of situations. And maybe there's a higher percentage in Canada than other places where the child's more detached from their parents for some kind of reason. Because maybe that might explain part of it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. It you know, sometimes you get on a plane, there's a baby that's really struggling, and that's a tough one for people. And most people are good-natured about it, and they try to, sometimes they try to help. Let me hold the baby. They think they've got the cure for it, you know. But probably every situation's different. I think with my kids, unless they were having a problem of some kind, they didn't feel good, they weren't too bad. They, you know, they basically cry to tell you they're hungry or they're tired or they need a new diaper.
Right.
Once you take care of those things, typically they're okay. But different babies are different.
Yeah. I'm not a father, but just seeing all the different children around, it is personality based, I guess, too. And sometimes parents have different strategies on how to stop kids from crying. But my sister's son, who lives in Australia, he's fat and happy, and he doesn't cry that much, and he's really just kind of a happy go lucky personality. But I think when you live close to the beach in Australia, you're probably going to be happy no matter what disposition you're in. But he's just a happy baby.
And they're different within families. My son came out crying, and my daughter came out calm as a cucumber. Calm, is that even an expression? Anyway, yeah. she was very calm until they threw her in the bath, and then she cried a lot. here's a list, too. Wallet Hub's list of most and least stressed states in the United States. Kind of interesting to look at. They look at a few factors here, including work-related stress, money-related stress, family-related stress, health and safety-related stress, and then they compile it all and come up with their list. The least stressful state in the U.S. is Minnesota, according to the list.
Interesting. I guess when your sports teams are never in the playoffs, it's you don't have any stress from that type of competition.
I don't know. Maybe so. North Dakota, Iowa, South Dakota, Utah, Nebraska, New Hampshire, Vermont, Colorado, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Kansas. Those are all states that aren't all that stressful, apparently. So, well, I mean, if you look at them, a lot of them have, you look at Colorado, you know, you have a lot of outdoor activities. Wisconsin's plenty of outdoor things, hunting, fishing, so forth. I don't know if that would be related to it. They look like states that aren't super densely populated. Maybe a couple of exceptions there, but maybe it's just because you get outside more or you have the potential to get outside more. I wonder if that has anything to do with it.
Yeah, it seems like they're all in the central United States. And then they're also more agricultural and less densely populated, like you mentioned. So maybe all those factors help people because they less live in cities and they're not as urbanized. Maybe that helps reduce the stress.
Could be. District of Columbia is number 18 for stress, but they're the worst state for money-related stress. But overall, number 18. Here's the top 10 most stressful states. Oh, by the way, Oklahoma's at number 15. So that would be interesting for the Oklahoma folks, for us. Here's the top 10, all the way to number 1 being the most stressful. Number 10, Arkansas. 9, Tennessee. 8, Georgia. 7, Nevada. 6, New Mexico. Number 5, Kentucky. Number 4, West Virginia. Number 3, Mississippi. Number 2, Louisiana. Number 1, Alabama. I wouldn't think of, I've not been to Alabama, so I don't know much about the state, but I would think more like California or something would be stressful, but no, Alabama's number one most stressful state in the U.S., they say.
Yeah, I would think it would be the big cities, New York, California, where Los Angeles is, but it seems like they're all in the southeast, so southern United States, and it's a little different, but they're all in that southern half of the United States, so it's that's really interesting. It's and I wonder if there's other data that correlates with jobs and maybe unemployment and all that sort of thing, too.
Yeah. So for Alabama, they come in number 5 for work-related stress, number 2 for money-related stress, 5 for family-related stress, and 6 for health and safety-related stress rank. So that's interesting. A lot of stress going on there.
Maybe it's because they that company bought Popeyes.
Yeah, maybe so. and it's interesting here too. I have to correct something I said earlier. District of the columns are a little bit skewed here. District of Columbia, they're number 1 in family related stress, not money related. They're number 14 with money. They're number 1 with family related stress. By a lot of politicians maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know. But anyway, that the column looked shifted to me, but they're number 1 for family related stress. Money related stress, the top state most stressful state is Mississippi, so I want to correct that. Make sure to give the due honor, I guess, to the states that have it coming.
Yeah, that's it's good to know, I guess, if people are looking to relocate and that kind of thing. But it is a little surprising. I would expect it'll be a little different, but some places struggle more than others, and I guess just some places are down their luck right now when it comes to all those sorts of things.
Here's something that's kind of interesting. Time Magazine does a feature, 10 questions, and they talk to John Lewis. You know who John Lewis is? Georgia congressman.
Okay. Yeah. I was thinking of a Canadian diplomat, but now that's a different Lewis. But yeah. I know this John Lewis, yeah.
Yeah, he's sort of he's discontented, I guess we'll say that, with the Trump administration, President Trump, and he's been sort of he's been a civil rights activist for a long time and protester and so forth. So they have a few questions with him here, and I just thought it was interesting just because it shows some of his thinking and his mentality, and maybe some of the mentality of some of the protests you might see from time to time. They ask him this question. They say, President Trump's time in office has inspired many protests, even though it hasn't been 100 days. As an expert protester, how would you like to be an expert protester? How does a resistance sustain long term? And John Lewis says this, in a movement involving protest, you must be able to give people a victory. You accept that victory and then you go on to something else. So I thought that was an interesting response because it indicates that you never stop protesting. You just keep trying to get more and more and more.
Yeah, I think it's ambiguous language because I think if you boil it down to specifics, it doesn't seem as idealistic because for protesting, you have to keep finding something to protest about, something negative about the status quo. And so you pretty much move on from item to item. And I think that just that implies perhaps that some of those things have to be not necessarily fabricated, but you have to find something no matter what in order to keep the movement going.
Yeah, I mean, if you even think about interpersonal relationships, if there's one person that really is upset with you, you'd want to solve it. And so you'd probably say, well, what's the problem? How could we solve this? And then if you solved it and then the next day they were mad at you again about something else, you know, it would be pretty disheartening. And that's what I think when I see a lot of the protests. I think, well, okay, so what do you want? Like, what would solve it? But this seems to indicate that there's nothing to solve, really. It's just a continual agitation to, I guess, get their every whim, which life really doesn't work that way.
Yeah, well, it just seems like most of the people participating in the protests don't really have an end game. Like, they don't have, well, what's the whole end goal of all this? Is it to get everything you want just for your own personal? Is it idealistic? Do you want some kind of person in government? Do you want some different kind of government? What's the point? And because protesting does have a place in, peaceful protesting has a place in American democracy, freedom of assembly, all that. But I don't think it was meant to be a continual form of lifestyle or a process which happens all the time. It's meant to be a demonstration for a really important issue. If you're always protesting all the time, I think that takes out of context the reason why it was started in the first place.
Yeah, this is 10 Questions, Time Magazine, with John Lewis, the Georgia congressman and veterans of the civil rights movement. They say to him, "You've long been a champion of nonviolence, but some of Time's coverage of your work in the 1960s was about how aggressive you were. Why do you think we got it so wrong?" I don't think, maybe they probably didn't get it wrong. But he says this, "What we did, and I'm not just saying this, it was new. I think it was called aggressive because we were persistent. We were insistent. You go to jail one day, they let you out the next day, you get arrested and go back to jail." That's a tough way to live, but that's the process that they're trying to get going.
Yeah, I think, I think one of the problems we have today is when we look back at the 1960s and the civil rights movement, we paint it with the same brush, which is the rosy glow of Martin Luther King Jr. and his idealism and his leadership. But I think if you look at it, most of what happened there wasn't his leadership. What he did, I think, on a scale, turned out a lot of good. But if you look at other things that happened, it was a violent time, violent student protests, just a lot of division in the country. It wasn't solving anything. There are some high points for sure, some good things that happened, but I think it's wrong to paint it all in the same light, kind of like how he's doing. And I'm sure some people are willing to live that life to get something, but a lot of people went to a lot more extremes than even just going to prison every day, breaking a law. And that's the, I think, the issue with it.
Yeah, and why are they going to jail?
Yeah.
It's not illegal to protest, but they're making it an issue.
Yeah.
So one last question here that they asked him, which I thought was interesting, sort of shows the spirit of some of these protests. John Lewis, 10 Questions from Time Magazine. They say, "You've described feeling, quote, the spirit of history tell you when you're meant to be doing something. What does that actually feel like?" He said, "It's more than physical. It's maybe psychological, but I think it's spiritual. It's saying that the moment is right, that the time is right." It's pretty ambiguous. You feel a spiritual push. Where does that come from?
Yeah, well, anytime you read something about some kind of spiritual impulse that motivates you to do something, most of the time that's not a good thing in hindsight. when you look at history, or specifically Bible history, because we're talking about spiritual impulses. And so yeah, it's just a very ambiguous thing. It's something that I think the phrase spirit of history makes you feel good about it. But maybe that's not the right spirit that's being implied.
He has one other Well, they ask him too, what do you think history demands of Americans now? And again, pretty ambiguous here. He says, which side are you on? I think history is saying to us today, not just in America, but around the world, which side are we on? Are we going to be on the right side or on the wrong side? That's pretty divisive. There's no common ground. We couldn't become unified in some way. And that's not explained. I mean, what are you using to determine right and wrong? And he says some stuff about, you know, the rich and the poor and things you'd expect to hear, but it's very ambiguous. Interesting. It's just interesting to look at some of the thinking behind some of those protests.
Yeah, well, especially since he's viewed as maybe the father of that, the last living link to that past, very prominent in that political movement. And if that's the way he thinks, then that's pretty much the way everyone in that kind of movement thinks, for the most part, probably, because he is the leadership and the brainchild of a lot of that. And I heard some people say that if you deal in absolutes in a democracy, it will never work, because democracy is based on compromise. Basically, you have two sides that oppose each other, but by finding that compromise, you find what's best for the country, because not everyone thinks like you. That's the whole point of having freedom of speech, and that you have different ideas and they can work together to find the best solution. If you're so dogmatic, now there are some subjects that you should be dogmatic on, but if you're so dogmatic and saying that you need to pick a side and basically do anything possible to defend that side, that's not the message that the country needs. And there's plenty of history of the Civil War when similar issues were at stake, where that you were forced to pick a side, North or South, and that it led to just a bloody conflict.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous if you're saying you have to pick a side based on a spiritual impulse,
yeah.
as he phrased it.
Yeah. And
what is that exactly? So just interesting. That's some of the words are from Time Magazine, and there are questions about some of the protests. Hey, you were listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. Also, send any comments you have to comments@kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. I'm Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau is here today. Abraham, a story from CNN.com. Not good news, especially for those battling the flu, because it's been a rough flu season.
Yeah.
This says, the title says here, the big one is coming, and it's going to be a flu pandemic. That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, this isn't a great positive report here. But experts are coming out and saying that the world is due for another flu pandemic. And if you look back, usually society works in great cycles of flu outbreaks. That every generation, basically, there's an outbreak of some kind of virus because it's new, it mutated or something like that. And so our immune systems internationally can't deal with it until we figure out a way, or until we have the antibodies to fight it over time. And so the experts, the medical experts, are saying we should expect to see a pandemic. And just to give you an idea of what they mean, like the scale of what we're talking about, it's not just something like Ebola or Zika, which we are able to kind of quarantine and stop for the most part. Not really, though. But basically, this is what they're talking about. The biggest one was the Spanish flu epidemic at the end of World War I, so about 100 years ago. 50 million people died worldwide. That's 20% to 40% of the world population got ill from it. So you're talking about almost half the world becoming ill from Spanish flu. 50 million people died, which is much more than World War I mm-hmm. killed people in a war. And then in the United States alone, about 675,000 people died from that one flu epidemic. And so that's if situations or if circumstances are right, that's what can happen. And they also talk about the AIDS outbreak, where 34,000 people in the U.S. died from that over time, from the AIDS epidemic that broke out in the 60s. But that's what can happen if all the circumstances and if everything's right with the flu, and that's something that we should probably take stock of today.
What conditions are they looking at? Does it have anything to do with antibiotics being used so much to where the body kind of... do they even use antibiotics when it comes to the flu or no?
Today we use vaccines.
Yeah.
But I think the circumstances are mainly basically like water, sanitation, the general health of society. But also I think another part is how much we rely on antibiotics. World War One, that's when penicillin was used a lot. And so Spanish flu partly was so deadly because penicillin wouldn't work. So we had to find a new vaccine to fight against it.
And yeah, so, because the reason I was thinking about that is you see stories pop up from time to time about how these illnesses sort of mutate, and you know, antibiotics has been a kind of a catch-all for a lot of different things. And but then if the strain becomes resistant, then what do you do?
Yeah,
right. So I don't know if that ties in with this exact story, but I've seen that happen with or those stories come up with other illnesses and things that people could get, infections and such.
Yeah, well, I think that's the main reason why they happen. From what I understand, that could be, there's probably more factors experts could point you to, but when we don't have anything in our bodies to resist it, that's when it becomes catastrophic. And that includes modern medicine. When some kind of flu strain becomes resistant to any kind of medicine that's available, it breaks out in a rapid way. And usually these pandemics or epidemics begin in third world countries or countries where there aren't good standards of cleanliness and living, and then it's transported around the world from there. And so the second half of this article, I think, is the most interesting, because it talks about our only hope, they say, is a vaccine to stop the next flu pandemic. And so they're talking about that instead of it taking years like it did in the past, or lots of many months to develop a vaccine, we can do it in about 20 weeks to develop some kind of vaccine. For example, it took 12 years to develop an Ebola vaccine. And it took basically 100 years to get a good typhoid vaccine that actually works after testing, and it would mutate and test again. So all these things are fine and good, but there's other studies saying that superviruses are becoming more frequent, which we have no idea how to fight them with any kind of vaccine. So if the next flu pandemic is something like a supervirus, no vaccine is going to save us, no matter how quickly we can get it out there.
Yeah, that's not a good not a good thing to think about, I guess. Well, it is good to think about it, but it's could be a little nerve-wracking. It's one of those things where you think about the flu and you think about it being uncomfortable for a few days and not feeling well and then moving on, but it is a killer if you can't control it. And then, like you say, if they don't have the medications to try to deal with it, then and we're so dependent on that, then you can have a problem.
Yeah, and that's the problem with how these pandemics, epidemics began, is that most of the time it's a pretty common strain of a flu, where it's not something, the symptoms aren't really unfamiliar. You have a stuffy nose, a cough, like a head cold sometimes, but then it just gets worse and worse until eventually you might die from it. Some people can catch it and they just have minor symptoms and they move on. It depends on each body's different too. So with something like that, if it did begin, it's hard to know when it's going to start. We're a lot much better at detecting them now than we were 100 years ago with the Spanish flu epidemic. But still, just in general, when you look at the hygiene and the different ways people in public are with anywhere you go in public, there's people coughing, sneezing, not practicing the laws of quarantine when they're sick. That it's those early days are most critical, because that's when it can spread before we're aware of it. It's not that hard to think that it could spread very, very quickly, because we don't really have the best standards of hygiene. Even we live pretty cleanly. We have sanitation and stuff, but just there's so much human interaction where we don't really practice quarantine and other things that could really stop it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We've got a few minutes left. Quickly, you're going to talk a little bit about some of the history of U.S. airstrikes, you know, thinking about what the U.S. did striking Syria here recently, and their effectiveness, and how effective have they been over the years?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think the verdict comes in that not that much. And based on what I, if you look at the broad scheme of history, that really the first time this strategy was used was in Vietnam with Operation Rolling Thunder, which was the big airstrikes ordered by Lyndon Johnson and other leaders to try to cripple North Vietnam. And they would allow their South Vietnamese army to attack and conquer them, and that never happened. And although airstrikes are a key part of any military operation, our experience in Vietnam shows you can't really do anything without ground forces. Even with the American military might, China and Russia gave North Vietnam sophisticated anti-air devices that pretty much nullified our air advantage. And interestingly enough, that's what Russia just said they would do for Syria. They'd improve Syria's air defenses by giving them maybe some more advanced Russian anti-air systems, just like they did with Iran. So when you're dealing with this, if you escalate in that way, airstrikes become null and void. I have some other interesting numbers, too. Just the amount of airstrikes the U.S. has done with the war on terror. I think that's the modern era we're kind of talking about. Fighting terrorism in other countries like Syria with just airstrikes, while supporting maybe some local fighters that actually do the ground fighting. And in the last four years of President Obama's presidency, there were over 20,000 airstrikes used across the world in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya, ordered not only drones but U.S. air forces. So 20,000 airstrikes, and they range in all different reasons on why they would do it. But just if you look at the past 10 years, obviously airstrikes aren't being that effective because we're still dealing with the same old enemies. Osama bin Laden wasn't killed in an airstrike. He was killed in a special operations raid. And I think when we're talking about killing key individuals or just making a stand in those sorts of things, airstrikes, they can be effective in a limited way. But if you really want to remove someone from power, you need a full military operation involving ground troops.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's easy, I guess, enough to think that maybe you could just use airstrikes alone and solve the problem and never put people on the ground, which is, I mean, people, you know, nobody wants to see boots on the ground, as they say. But I guess history shows us that if you really want to conquer another enemy or you want to remove somebody, you kind of have to get down there and take care of business on the ground.
Yeah, I think for the United States, airstrikes seem like a good middle ground because it looks like you're doing something. You don't have to ask. People don't die. Your own people don't die. Usually they can be done from drones or from ships hundreds of miles away from where they're actually firing to. And so to an American leader, they're very attractive because it's minimal effort on your part and it can cause fear and send a message internationally. So there is a purpose for them. But I think when you're actually talking about the situation in Syria, or in Vietnam or other ground wars that are going on, where in Syria we're supporting a ground war against Assad by supporting the rebels. They're obviously not cutting it, and in fact, they're probably just going to make things worse and worse unless we use more force, because now if Russia gives Syria all these advanced anti-air devices, now none of the coalition from Europe and the United States can operate in Syria. So who's going to have air superiority now? It's going to be Russia and Assad. So it just made things even worse than it was before because we wasted 4 years since 2013 not doing anything anyway. But we're using minimal force and we're getting minimal results.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at some of that history in relation to what's happening now about with those airstrikes the U.S. launched against Syria. There's more about that at thetrumpet.com. Also check out the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Trumpet Hour Week in Review program in the Key of David, as well this weekend here on KPCG. That's all the time that we have on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondo, thanks for spending some time with us. Have a great, great weekend, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.